Mitzvah Shin Mem Gimel 343. Shelo Lehalvos Beribis LeYisrael. Very famous and extensive prohibition of the Torah, which is that one may not lend or borrow with interest when you're dealing with two Jews. Shelo lehalvos beribis liYisrael, that one should not lend with interest to a Jew. It also applies to the borrower. Shenemar eskas bechalu sitein lo beneshech, you shall not give your money to him with literally biting. Uvimarbis lo sitein ochlecha, and you shall not give your food with an added price.
If you're biting it,
you'd
be a loan shark.
You know, right? Ah, yeah, we have such a language in English as well. The Ein Elu Shnei Lavin, the Torah expresses itself twice about the prohibition of ribis, of interest, but it's not actually two separate mitzvot. Shaharibis hu neshech v'neshech haribis. Neshech and ribis are two different words for the same thing. They're synonymous. As the sages say in Bava Metzia, so there's no such thing as neshech without ribis, and there's no such thing as ribis without neshech. That's two things are synonymous. So why did the Torah express itself with two different things? So why didn't the Torah just say, don't give your money or your food with interest? So by the way, of course, the Torah means that it's not even specifically money. That any object that you give to another, you know, you can't ask for more back. So if you say, hey, I'm going to lend you one apple today, as long as you pay me back two apples tomorrow. So that would not be permissible. So it applies to money and the ochel, or any object. Lavor Allah bishnei lavin kolomer laharbos ha'azharosela. But it doesn't mean literally that you violate two negative commandments. It's only one negative commandment. But the Torah repeats itself in order to emphasize the severity of the prohibition, which happens all the time in the Torah. You have the prohibition of idolatry, which we mentioned in the drasha yesterday. So that is repeated many, many times throughout the Chumash. And the idea is not that there is more than one prohibition against idolatry, but rather it's just God trying to emphasize that it's really, really bad, and he really wants us to get it into our heads that we're not supposed to worship idols. And this is a very extensive area of halacha, and even though it's a lengthy presentation relative to the most of the mitzvahs in the Sefer HaChinuch, it doesn't really begin to discuss all the possible cases of ribis. But there is what's called a matana. There is possible there in terms of at least on a deraisa level, if you give a present, that a voluntary present, because you want to express appreciation for somebody extending you a loan. So if it's an explicit acknowledgement of the loan, and you're not, you know, good friends, you wouldn't give each other presents all the time, that would be absolutely impermissible based on ribis. But in theory, technically, it's possible in certain situations to borrow money and then give back the money and give an extra present, a totally voluntary present to the lender, and it would not technically fall under the category of ribis. But again, exactly when that would be permissible is very docistic. Yeah?
Would it be permissible for someone to, as a way of inducing someone to provide a loan, give a present in advance?
Nope. That's actually an explicit. It's an excellent question. That's discussed explicitly towards the end, actually, of the Sefer HaChinuch discussion, that you're not allowed to do that.
And also, I mean, you're not allowed to behave differently towards the borrower, the lender.
Correct. There's also what's called ribis dvarim, that if you lend your money to someone and the person is very appreciative of lending the money, so all of a sudden, you know, he knocks on your door every morning while you're eating breakfast. Hey, you know, I just want to say good morning. How are you? Something that was not be done before. So that is also prohibited, because that's considered to be an extra favor that the person is doing to you. That is pretty explicitly linked to the fact that you provided him a loan. If you're best friends, so then it's okay. But
so, in other words, the only safe way to lend money,
because he was also like a friend or something.
Yeah, whatever. You know.
Well, if you're friends, so then the rules are relaxed. That's 100% right. That if you're friends with people, then we're not as medactic with ribis. So if you borrow, You know, friends will borrow food items. You know, oh, I ran out of a cup of sugar. Can I have a cup of sugar? So here, so you borrow a cup of sugar. And then if you're friends, you'll fill up the cup of sugar in return. Maybe you'll add a little extra. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, nobody cares. It's not, yeah. If it's not something that people are medactic about, so then it's not not going to be ribbis. If you're not good friends with a person, so then you're going to be careful that you give back the exact amount of sugar that you borrowed.
Yeah, the same thing, like, we don't have inflation in the United States a lot, but let's say countries that do have inflation, you can give somebody a loan, and a year later, 20% is gone.
That, yeah, that's a complicated shaila of how to deal with that. Yeah, yeah, that's a good question. Bezeha inyan, hu mimasha amarti lamala. There's a great book for anyone who's interested, by Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, who's famous for his shiurim on Motzei Shabbos. Very entertaining, very good shiurim. I'm not disparaging them. I'm just a little bit amusing that they're called Novi shiurim. So he wrote a book, I believe it might have been his first book, called The Laws of Ribbis, an art scroll book, which is all about all the contemporary applications of the laws of ribbis. If you want an extensive analysis of the Talmudic sources about ribbis, that book is not what it's all about. It's simply it's a lot of work went into it. It discusses all the possible contemporary issues that have come up, which people might need to know for the laws of ribbis. You know, bonds, how that relates to ribbis, things like that. Okay. I mean, Israeli bonds. For American bonds, it's a goyish entity, so it's not. There's no problem with ribbis at all. V'zeh inyan who might be mash she'amarti lemala ki haTorah tichbol hazharos lifamim al mash shechafei tzakel arachikenu imenu harbe. So sometimes the Torah repeats itself when God wants to distance us greatly from this issue. The efshe shenemar v'zeh ke'ein mash yomer zichron lebracha binyanim achirim dibra Torah kiloshin bnei adam. So the Torah speaks according to how people speak. So sometimes people repeat themselves, so sometimes the Torah also repeats itself. So it just tells us many warnings for things that it really wants us to be careful about. That when you want to be very careful about something, so you're going to tell someone once, and then you're going to text them, you know, a day later to remind them. You know, if there's something you really, really want to make sure this person remembers and is careful about, you're not going to tell them once. You want to tell your housekeeper, you know, your goyish housekeeper doesn't know how to keep kosher, so you're trying to instruct her how to do, you know, remember, wash the fleishig dishes in the right-hand sink, the meat dishes. So then she's not going to really remember, so you're going to call her up. What sink are you washing the dishes in? No, you're going to see when you really want to be careful about something, so you have to remind them many times, yeah?
Now, I think the prohibition, Avas Ger, is repeated, I think, 36 times in the Torah.
Yeah.
Is that the most often repeated one?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Or according to
the... It's the hardest. Not the hardest, obviously, but it's hard, you know, keeping track of who's a convert and who's not a convert. So a lot of converts, so some converts, you look at them, take one look, and you know right away. But many converts blend in very well in the Jewish community. So you don't really know, as if they were born Jews. So you don't really know who's a convert and who's not a convert. So you have to, or even if you know, when you're just stopped talking to the person, it's very easy to forget that they're a convert because they blend in so well. So you have to keep in mind. Hamizoras nizgar vizaris al inyan al kapanim. So the person who is being reminded and warned should be extra careful about this subject. Bim omnam ki roi adam. What do you mean? God tells you once, you should do it. You shouldn't need to be more than one reminding. It's God. Not like your parents are reminding you to take out the trash. That's also important. It's a mitzvah as well, but here it's this higher level. So even if God alludes to it in a slight way, you should be on top of it. So this is, it's God being nice to us in a certain way, that even though God should say, hey, I'm God, I tell you even with one word, do this, and so you should do it. I shouldn't need to remind you more than once. You know, I'm God, you should pay attention to me extra. So it's a nice thing that God does for us to remind us many times in the Torah. So when we're listening in shul to the Torah reading or learning Chumash, so we it drills it into us more and more. And we're more likely to listen because, as we know, we don't always, when we hear these commandments, we don't always fully internalize really the fact as to who is commanding us to do it. That's why, you know, if we really, and we go to davening, if you really got the idea that, if we really internalized that we are going to shul to talk to God, God's waiting for us, so to speak, and we are missing our appointment with God, so will we ever be late for shul? Would such a thing be possible? So, no, if we really understood it, so we would never be late for shul, but most people, myself included, I'm not excluding myself, don't really fully get it. So that's why sometimes one can be late for shul. Kasher yiyaser ish es b'no. So this is like God relating to us as if we're his children, and is going to warn us many times. Okay, no delishmo hagadol sela barov hatovos asher gimalanu baruch hu. So we're going to thank him for all the wonderful things he does for us. Mishor she mitzvah kosavti bazharas Arev Eidim v'Sofer Shlis Asku b'Milva Ribis b'Chesef Tal v'Beiz v'Kochenu Misham. Remember all the way back to Parshas Mishpatim, the second half of Parshas Mishpatim, where the Sefer Chinuch calls Parshasim Kesef. So there, the Sefer Chinuch mentioned that there is, in addition to the mitzvah that on the borrower and the lender, there is a prohibition that you're not allowed to serve as a middleman between people who are lending beribis, as the scribe to draw up a document that mentions a loan which is done beribis, you're not allowed to be witnesses. So all those people actually violate a biblical negative commandment. Okay, not as severe in a certain sense, but there is an actual mitzvah for them as well. So it says that the point is that people should be good to each other, that we shouldn't end up, you know, depleting all of another's assets by paying of interest. And of course, the famous explanation as to why this applies to Jews only and not to non-Jews is because it's like the Jewish people are all part of a free loan society. We're supposed to be, in other words, there's nothing ethically wrong with charging ribis, with charging interest, but Jews are supposed to treat each other like brothers, you know, brothers who are family, close family members in general. Lend to will extend free loans to each other. They won't insist on the interest. We're supposed to treat the entire Jewish people as if they are all close family members, and we should not charge interest. So for non-Jews, so you're allowed to charge interest. And indeed, this caused a lot of problems for Jews in the Middle Ages because this was one of the occupations that they could do. They couldn't own land. They weren't part of the feudal system. So they were moneylenders. So this caused a lot of resentment that the non-Jews had a lot of debt to Jews, and led to a lot of problems. Yeah.
It should be pointed out, the awful hal deals, that this caused enormous problems for the Christians, because they took this very seriously, and they prohibited usury, you know, taking of interest. You know, so to the point that the only people, in fact, who were able to, you know, allowed to do it were the Jews and the Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So that actually had a stranglehold on the European economy. In fact, up until the time of the Renaissance, when essentially they, you know, Italians and others kind of figured out how the heck with us, we here, you know, they came up with their own idea of a, hey, you know, heterisk or something like that, and they just ignored it entirely. But anyway, but this was actually a big problem for the Christians. And one thing happened in the Crusades was that all of a sudden all these feudal lords, when they had to go off to the infidels in the Holy Land, they need liquid assets all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
So all they could do is go ahead and borrow money from Jews. They couldn't sell the land they had and so on. And then that also caused problems when they came home and found they had to pay it back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they couldn't, in fact, borrow money from each other. It was
So Christians are inconsistent about which rules of the Bible they apply and which they don't apply. So one of them that they did apply was that, which is not one of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, so according to us, they're perfectly allowed to charge interest to each other, but one of the rules from the Old Testament that they latched onto is that they should not charge interest to fellow Christians. So yeah, so the Jews were the available moneylenders, so they were both from the perspective of the non-Jews and from the perspective of Jews, so a usury relationship between a Jew and a non-Jew was permissible, but it created a lot of resentment. Yeah. Dinei ha-mitzvah kigon ha-chilukim shelimdunu zichron el-vracha ba-azhar azu. So there are different types of ribis, of interest. She-yamru she-ish ribis shu-asr min ha-Torah. There's interest that's biblically prohibited. V'zehu she-nikra l-rabbaseinu zichron el-vracha. This is what our sages call ribis kitzutza. set ribis. V'yesh ribis shehu lemata mimenu. There is ribis that is on a lower level. V'hu asur midrabanan. That's the rabbinically prohibited type of ribis. Ukro zichronam levracha avak ribis. The dust of ribis. That we know when there's a lot of times where we have a prohibition that's on a lower level, so it's called avak. Just the dust of it. You know, that when the real prohibition settles, so there's dust that comes out, so there's that's called the dust. So we also have avak lashon hara, which is a second and secondary type of lashon hara. So here too, avak ribis is a secondary type of ribis, which is prohibited only rabbinically. V'yesh ribis acheres ulamata mishneilu harishonim, and there's one that's even on a lower level, v'hu min hadin mutar. Technically speaking, in terms of ribis per se, it should be permissible both midaraisa and midarabanan. Lefishu racho karbe min ribis haaser min haTorah ad she'en ligzarav lalav klal. So it's totally far removed from the ribis, which is biblically prohibited. Aval chachomim echmiru be'inyan birosam achomer she'echmir haTorah v'rov hazaras bedvar haribis. Vasru k'dei shelu ya'arimu b'nei adam litol ribis. So they said it doesn't really fall under any of the categories of ribis, either biblical or rabbinic. But nevertheless, we say you shouldn't do it because it's a harama. It looks like a trick that you're doing to get out of ribis, so therefore we don't want you to do it because the ribis is such a stringent mitzvah in the Torah. So you shouldn't even do something that looks like you're trying to get around it. Lo mipnei davar acher, not for any other reason. Ve'elu heina shlosha minei ribis, she'amarnu, ribis asu dvar Torah. So what is ribis that is biblically prohibited? So it's what we generally think of, straightforward interest. Who call me she'omer l'chaveiro, halveini mana, v'tein lach mimenu pruta b'chol yom. Lend me a mana, and until I pay you back, I'm going to give you a pruta every day. Interest.
I mean, it seems like to say, but it's possible to lend somebody and say, you can give me back less than the amount that I lend you, in order to have negative interest.
If I say, here, I'm lending you a mana, and I want you to pay me back 90,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's like giving a present. Yeah. Right.
No, in other words,
it's not interest, right, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
But interest is paying back more.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you pay back less, so he's giving you a present, basically. He's giving you, yeah.
Okay. All right, just, you know.
Yeah. Oh, 30 prutos b'chodesh, I'll give you 30 prutos a month until I pay it back. The exact amount doesn't matter. Ad she'efer enu lach, until I pay you back. So lend me 100 dinarim and I'll pay you back 120 for the course of the year. I'm missing a cut off a word here. What is next word? Until you give it back. So I lend you money, and in exchange, you're going to mortgage essentially your property. So until you pay me back, I get to enjoy the produce of your property. So if you have a house or a field, so I get to enjoy the field or the house until you pay me back, so that's also considered ribis. Mm-hmm. That means if I don't subtract anything from the loan. So if I say, here, I'm lending you $100, and in the meantime, I use your house until you pay me back, so that's okay. But if I say, I'm going to use your house, but I'm going to subtract, $20 from the loan for use of your house, so it's like rent. So that's not ribis, right? Zeo ribis kitzutza haser min haTorah. So all these examples are ribis kitzutza, set ribis, or determined in advance ribis, which is prohibited on a daraisa level. So this, to summarize, has to be, in order to be ribis on a daraisa level, it has to be in the method of a loan, not a business transaction. It has to be from the lender to the borrower, and it has to be determined in advance. Okay? Those are the basic rules of ribis kitzutza, ha'asar min haTorah.
Isn't that the case, though, that lending is a financial transaction.
What do you mean?
Whether it's done as on a business basis or not on a business basis, it's a financial transaction.
Well, there is such a thing as an investment. That's what was alluded to before, that there's something called an iska. If you have a business venture with someone, so that's not subject to ribis, because let's say Harry has no money and he wants to open a store. Okay, Chas v'Shalom, we shouldn't give an ayin hara. Should have lots and lots of money, but for our example, Harry has no money. So Harry has no money, but he really wants to open a store. Okay? So he says to me, please lend me $1,000 to open the store. So I give him $1,000 to open the store. He opens it. So we get to share the profits. He pays me back $1,000, like I invested in the original property. But he pays me much more than that because I'm going to, as an investment, that's what investors do. You want to share in the profits of the store. So when it's really a joint business venture, so then it's permissible. Yeah, and the idea is that I'm investing with him rather than giving him a pure loan. Then then that is not subject to prohibition of ribis.
Even though upfront you indicate that you're giving the money on condition that it bring a return?
No, excellent, excellent, excellent point. So an investment means that there's some risk of loss. That I trust that Harry is an excellent businessman. So when I give him my $1,000, I don't say, hey, you have to pay me back $1,000. I'm saying, here's $1,000, go open the store, and I expect some share in the profits. I expect to make more than $1,000. But maybe Harry's store tanks, so I lost my money. Too bad. If he would pay me back the $1,000 anyway, then that would be an indication that that was a ribis type of loan transaction and not actually an investment.
So, they're getting head results. How's the head risk work then?
There is an institution called a heter iska, which is not mentioned in the Gemara, but it was developed in the times of the Rishonim and Acharonim in order to set loans up in a manner that was really a business transaction rather than a pure loan, which enables Jews essentially to lend and borrow with interest as long as it's set up as a business transaction. And you might think, you know, this is like a harama, this is like a trick, you know, like mechiras chametz, like heter mechira. But somehow, this, because, you know, the rules of ribis are more, I don't know, malleable is not really the right word, but there's a lot of details in how they're applied. And it has to really fit into a certain mold in order to be prohibited due to ribis. So restructuring the loan as a business investment was not really viewed as a harama, but rather simply as a restructuring of the loan. So of all the tricks in halacha, the heter mechira, mechiras chametz, all these things, so this was the least controversial. Doesn't mean it wasn't controversial at all, but this is the least controversial one of them. So basically the way a heter iska works by restructuring the loan as a business transaction is as follows. So Harry really wants to borrow $1,000 from me to start the store. And basically the way it has to work in order to restructure it as a business transaction is, let's see, Stam wants to borrow money without starting a store, and that was not a good example. He wants to Stam borrow money, not starting a store, but he's going to do some business with it. He's going to use it for something, and hopefully he's going to make some money with it. He's not going to lose money on it. So the way it works is, A, I have to pay Harry a non-refundable fee that he is my emissary to do business with my money. So I give him $1,000, and I say, here's my $1,000, plus here I'm giving you $1, that this is your, I'm hiring you to be my financial manager. So I want you to be my financial manager. So that $1 indicates that it's a business transaction in addition to, and not just a loan. In addition, there has to be at least a theoretical risk of loss. If I say, here's $1,000 and I expect it back and I expect some profits, so that's a loan with ribis, that's not a business transaction. So I have to say, here's the $1,000, and I assume risk.
Harry, you can always vouch on the loan, that's a risk, you know, I mean, right? You know, you can declare bankruptcy or something like that, not have the money.
Right, we don't have the money, so you can't pay it back.
That's but then there's always a risk in lending money. You can always lose principal when you lend money. You know, that's not.
Well, he's mechuyev to pay it back. If it's a pure loan, a free loan, you know, that's permissible min haTorah, so then he has to pay it back. And there's no such thing. Eventually, you have to pay it back. If a Bezdin will, you know, take the shirt off his back to pay the loan if necessary. But, so there has to be some risk of loss, and the way that works, in order to make sure that it's almost certain that I'm going to get my $1,000 back, because I want it sort of to be a loan, but sort of a business transaction. Basically, what you do is you place a high standard of proof on Harry that that was my actual money that was lost. So I say, so Harry, okay, you don't have to pay back my part in the business, which would be $500 or something. I invest half and half. We assume that we each manage half. So you don't have to pay back. You don't have to pay back my money that was lost, provided you bring two kosher witnesses who view that it was my money being lost, and therefore you wouldn't have to pay it back. So that high standard is basically impossible. In theory, it's possible, but it's very, very difficult to adhere to. So it's basically a guarantee that I'm going to get my money back in addition with some profits. So that's basically the way a heter iska works, that you have to assume at least some theoretical possibility that your money will be lost, and Harry won't be absolutely required to pay it back. And B, you have to pay him some money up front that makes him your employee to deal with your money.
Now, why wasn't this particular harama controversial, as opposed to like heter mechira and the, you know, and the...
I didn't say it wasn't controversial at all. I said it was the least controversial.
I mean, because in the face of it, this is being mevatel, a very strong Isser D'Oraisa, you know, I mean.
It's less being mevatel and Isser D'Oraisa more than it is being mevatel the mitzvah to lend Jews money for free when necessary. Because on a D'Oraisa level, so this is, it's not a loan, it's a business transaction. So then you'll be allowed to get more from your return than, from more return on your money than you dished out.
Well, that's what Hira could be, you know, as we mentioned before, it could be something in fact which is only against the Drabun and possibly, you know, and then anything like this, you know, but that's actually very controversial.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just saying, in terms of something which seems on the face of it, fishy.
Fancy footwork.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is, you know, the idea that, I mean, the, you know, I just, you know, is it, anyway, was it in fact non-controversial because otherwise it would be impossible for Jews to, you know, manage their financial affairs?
I mean, with all these haramas, so it's the ones who allow it say it's a, I mean, there are more people who allow heter mechira, I mean, heter iska lechatchila than who allow a... heter mechira or mechira schamitz, but even those who permit, most people don't. With the others, there's more of a recognition that it's not ideal than it is with a heter iska. Heter iska. So sometimes you need money and you need to make a business transaction out of it in order to be able to have commerce in society. But you're right. There is this idea that you can't manage without it. It's a good point. As Rabbi Reisman has in his Sefer brings a story from the Chofetz Chaim that he used to say that his father would sometimes borrow money relying on a heter iska, but he would never lend money relying on a heter iska. Because when he needed the money, he needed the money, but he would never want to be mevatel the mitzvah sasei to lend to a Jew without ribbis, to give Jews free loans when necessary.
Yeah, somebody really should collect all these stories and come up with the tales of Misnagdim.
Mm-hmm.
How all these Mishnagos and Gedolim were pathologically honest. You know, that would be an interesting. No miracles, no, you know, nothing flashy like that, but it might be actually useful. You know.
I hear. Nu Karyana di Garta. If you mention the idea, you should do it. It can be your retirement project to write a book, Tales of Mishnagdim. So, where Heter Iska really does come into play is when you have something. Even if, okay, so some people don't want to rely on it for a person-to-person transaction because it looks too much like a loan and it looks like a harama. But when you have a Jewish bank, for example, that really is doing business deals, so you have even the post-game who say that you better not rely on heter iska from person-to-person, so are pretty okay with it when it comes to a bank, when it comes to Israeli bonds. So all these things rely on the heter iska. I first looked this up many years ago when I think my grandmother she purchased some Israeli bonds in my name, and she was forwarding me the interest payments. I was like, wait a minute, you know, much younger, and you know, didn't know as much about this. So yeah, not that I'm an expert on rubles nowadays, but so I looked up in Rabbi Reisman's sefer. So he says that even those who don't rely on the heter iska from person to person, so many people feel that the state of Israel is an entity that would be allowed to pay ribis anyway, because it's Ramosha has a kula by corporations. That corporations are not considered Jewish, so they're allowed to pay interest. Not everybody agrees with that. The state of Israel also is not a Jewish person. So therefore, according to many, they'd be allowed to pay interest even without the heter iska, and B, they have a heter iska, so it's not, so that most poskim say it's meruvach, that it's 100% permissible to purchase Israeli bonds, yeah? So for heter iska, so when you buy an Israeli bond, you don't sign a heter iska, right? When you do a heter iska with a person-to-person loan, then you have draw up a document, you put in all the details, and you have to understand it. Ramosha says, this is a oft-quoted line from Ramosha in his Chuvis, that he says, in order for a heter iska to be valid, the parties have to realize what it is, that it's exactly how it turns a loan into a business transaction, because it really doesn't work. If you think it's like a magic spell that removes the prohibition of ribis, then that's really bad. And the heter iska would not be valid in such a situation. So really, lechatchila, you should understand the heter iska. But you have a corporation like a bank or a country which is dealing with the heter iska, so it's just this written into their bylaws that all their transactions will be in accordance with the heter iska. It's like a generalized heter iska rather than a person-to-person transaction. So again, the most poskim would be okay with it on a larger scale, when it really does resemble more a business transaction rather than with a person-to-person loan. V'derech kal amru zichron al-vracha, sages tell us, kol agar notar le'azer min ha-Torah, any wages that you pay someone for holding on to your money, then that is prohibited min ha-Torah. V'hu sheba miyad lo ve'lamalvet, from the hand of the lender to the borrower, Zehu haribis aser dvar Torah. That's the deraisa dekeribis. All of the yamru zichron al-vracha ribis kitzutza yotze b'dayanim. So if you engage in a loan which is in violation of ribis deraisa, so then the bezdin can forcibly remove it from you and give it back to the lender. Kolomer shebezdin yordan l'nifse amalve motzien menu kemo b'gzelus v'chavol. Just like if you steal something, so bezdin forcibly removes it from you. That they don't actually go into your property and remove it, but rather they force you with any means necessary to pay it back yourself. That the lender has to return it, you beat him until he agrees. It's more analogous to what happens when somebody says, I am not going to perform a mitzvah sase. That the rule is that even though, you know, a mitzvah saseh is not usually subject to lower penalties in halacha than violating a mitzvah lo saseh, if you're so chutzpahdik as to go in front of the bezdin and you say, I am not going to fulfill this mitzvah saseh, this positive commandment, something active that you have to do, so such a chutzpahdik ezach, they beat you until you agree to do it. So if you go on Erev Pesach and you say, hey bezdin, you know, I'm not going to eat matzah tonight. So, Bezdin takes out their whips, you know, and they beat you until you agree to do it.
The positive is to give a get, too, right? So,
okay. A get is different. A get is different because, there are only a few cases where this is permissible by a get. So, a get has to be given of the husband's volition, because as v'chasav la sefer krisus, that the husband is fundamentally obligated to write the get, even though nowadays the husband doesn't really write the get, but appoints a sofer to do it in his stead. So if he doesn't want to write it, there's no divorce. Husband has to write the. It stems from the fact that the husband has to write the document. So it's up to him to write it. So in general, if a husband is forced to give a get, then the get would be invalid, because that's called the get meusa. There are a few cases in halacha that are explicitly recorded as that you do force the husband, and the Rambam explains that really it's something, since the halacha is absolutely clear here that the couple is required to get divorced, so really the husband deep down wants to fulfill the halacha, he wants to do what God says, and really you're just helping him realize it by the beating. So, but this only applies to cases where the halacha is explicit that the couple has to get divorced. The halacha, if they're just not having a happy marriage, so the halacha is not explicit they have to get divorced, and it would be subject to the husband's volition, so you have to be induced to give a get in other ways.
So in other words, an aguna should run out and have an affair or something like that in that case.
That's not kviya. Not a situation of kviya. Oh. One of the situations of kviya, for example, is if the husband at the time of marriage was a banker, and then all of a sudden, as a few years down the line, he decides to become a tanner, leather tanner. So people, when they didn't have as good hygiene, didn't have gloves, they didn't have, you know, machines to do it for you. So people who are tanners of leather smelled absolutely horrendous. Absolutely terrible. So no woman could be expected to live with a man who was a tanner. I mean, if they got married and she went, and he was a tanner, so obviously she says, you know, she agrees to it. Okay, so then there's no kviya lagarish. But if he becomes a tanner, then you force the husband to give a get because that's what's recorded in halacha. So there are very few situations where a get me'usa actually works.
It's not how it's done.
Yeah, but again, it only applies to explicitly recorded cases. If the wife says, I want to get divorced, and the husband says, I don't want to get divorced, So then there's no recourse unless you have one of the mechanisms. You have a halachically acceptable, you know, prenuptial agreement, which basically the different shittas about what types of prenuptial agreements are acceptable. But one of them is that the husband agrees at the time they get married that I'll present Rabbi Blech's way, okay? Because that's more poskim Rabbi Blech's way than the RCA way, although many poskim the RCA way also. Rabbi Blech's version of the prenuptial agreement, which is based on the Nachla Shiva, very early sources, is that the husband has a Torah obligation to support his wife. So basically you sign a document from the beginning of the marriage where the husband and wife agree that the wife has two options. Either she can, you know, go to the fridge and take out dinner or make dinner or, you know, just whatever, just share food in the house, which is the normal way where that husband supports his wife with food. He doesn't, you know, give her, you know, handouts. It's not usually how it works. Or, if she wants, she cannot take any of the husband's food, and she can receive $150 a day. At any point in the marriage, she can she can have this choice. So long as they're happily married, they're gonna share the food in the fridge. But if the wife wants to get divorced, she's gonna say to her husband, hey, I'm not interested in your food anymore, so I'm invoking the contract we signed when we first got married, that instead of going into the fridge, so I want my $150 a day. They're going to say, okay, we're going to the Beis Din, we'll have a get. I'm not interested in paying you $150 a day. And that's basically the way the prenuptial agreement. The RCA one is a little different. That is not an option that the wife can tap into right away in the beginning of the marriage, but rather it's only something that kicks in later on, if the wife says she wants to move out, so and she says, hey, I still get my mizonos, I still want my money, my to be supported with food, so then you have to start giving me $150 a day. So that's the way the RCA one works, so that Rabbi Blech doesn't like, because he says, what?
Because he says
it's an asmachta, which the Sefer HaChinuch is going to discuss, actually, later on regarding ribis, but he says when the husband signs it originally, it's a penalty that he imposes on himself way in the future. Well, one day, in 10 years, my wife is going to want to take my money instead of my food, and she's going to move out of my house. You know, that's ridiculous. Okay, I'll sign it, whatever. But he doesn't really mean it, and that would be considered to be an inappropriate financial penalty to induce the husband to give a get, and that would, according to Rabbi Blake, so that would not be acceptable. Many poskim do like that. I don't know. I never got a clear answer on why the RCA doesn't just do the Rabbi Blake prenup way, because that's acceptable according to anyone, but for some reason they have their cheshbonis and they want to do it their way. Yeah?
I mean, we're getting a little bit far afield here.
Yeah?
I'm just kind of curious. This question of the
also different from what you call a mekach tos. Mm-hmm. That if there's something that was hidden from the wife, and it was something that there's a in umdana de muchach, that there's something known that no woman would agree to marry such a man, so then that's different. That's not a kviya lagarish, that's nullifying the original kiddushin. because it was considered to be kiddush etos, and just any like any financial transaction which is done under false pretenses. So a marriage which is conducted under false pretenses is not valid. So here, the tanner, by the time they get married, was not a tanner. So it's not under false pretenses. You know, intentions of becoming a tanner, perhaps. But it was later on down the line.
Better example, let's say.
Kol sha'ar haribios, all the types of interest, she'efshe lekabel chutz me'elu she'amarnu, that besides these which we just mentioned, ein nikrayim ribis derabanan v'nikrayim avak ribis, they're only derabanan, ve'ein ha'yotze b'dayanin, and will not be, the rabbinical court cannot physically extract the money and give it back to the lender. That you shouldn't get involved in anything coming close to ribis deraisa, so therefore they forbade these other secondary types of ribis as well. You do not receive what's called an iron sheep. What's an iron sheep? So tzon barzel we mostly know when we're discussing a marriage. So the wife brings into marriage two different types of property, conceivably. One is called Nichsei Milug, and one's called Nichsei Tzon Barzel. So Nichsei Tzon Barzel is like a dowry that comes in and is used by the husband in any way. Yeah. And there's what's called Nichsei Milug, which is property that remains the property of the wife, but the husband is entitled to enjoy the profits of these monies. So if she brings in a vineyard, so she remains the owner of the vineyard, but the husband gets to harvest the grapes every year until the marriage ends. So tzon barzel is like a dowry. That's something that's totally becomes the property of the husband. But here it's used in a sense. Perish tzon barzel is not a marriage. Hamekabel mamon miYisrael al tanai. So you receive property, and it's under the condition that the property will remain the property of the original owner, but nevertheless, you will take, when you're harvesting, you will take a chelek, you will take some of the property, some of the profits that will accrue. So then that would not be permissible, because that would be considered to be usage of the property without any risk whatsoever, and you simply take some extra amount, rather than, again, assuming some risk. Okay.